right about now. It's sponsored by Scrivener 3, the software designed specifically for writers. Scrivener 3 has everything you need to research, compose, organize, edit, and finish a piece of writing. Go to writeaboutnowmedia.com and click on the Scrivener link with a giant S. Enter the coupon code writeaboutnow and get 20% off. That's right, 20% off.
It's almost about that time. Right about now.
Right about now. Right about, right about, right about now.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Right About Now, the show that takes a deep dive into the origin stories of successful writers and editors. I'm your host, Jonathan Small, and it is a pleasure to have you here with me today. Thanks so much for joining. My guest today, the editor-in-chief of Cosmo, the editorial director of Women's Health and 17, Michelle Promolyko.
Cosmo's mission, first and foremost, is to empower women and to give them the tools to live the life that they want to live the fun, fearless life that we always talk about in Cosmo. At the same time, we have a long history of celebrating men, and it feels really difficult to do that right now. To laud men is unpopular.
Okay, so excited to get to my interview with Michelle. But before I jump right into it, I do have a small favor to ask you, a Jonathan Small favor, if you will. If you go to my website right now, writeaboutnowmedia.com/survey, you will find a survey, a very, very short survey that will help me better understand what you would like to hear on this podcast. Because look, I have been doing this for 6 months and the listenership just keeps going up and up. And I know I'm doing something right, but I want to do more of something right and I want to do less of something wrong. And it would be so helpful if I could just get a little bit of feedback about what you'd like to hear on the show, which guests you'd like me to feature. Would you like me to feature more instructional type content? So again, if you go to writeaboutnowmedia.com/survey, I'll also leave a link in the description of this podcast. But if you can go to that link and take this quick survey, it would mean the world to me. Thank you.
Michelle Promolyko, welcome to Write About Now. I'm so excited you're here. This is so fun.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we probably have not seen each other in 20 years.
Let's not count.
Let's call it 15. Yeah, it was about 15 years. Yeah, because I mean, it was in preschool that we met. So that was always
exactly,
really fun.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
So where did you come from? Like, give me a little origin story of Michelle.
Okay, well, my origin story is I grew up in a really exotic place called New Jersey.
Oh, I know. I've heard of it.
Yeah. And I went to Rutgers to study journalism. And the greatest thing about that is it's a train ride away from New York, which is, you know, the hub of publishing. So I was able to do all these incredible internships.
Oh, where'd you intern?
Okay, so I interned at Harper's Bazaar in the fashion department.
That's cool.
And that's when Liz Tolbaris was the editor, and there were so many storied fashion editors there at the time. So that was incredible. I interned at a now defunct magazine called McCall's. And the funny thing is Kate White was the editor-in-chief of McCall's at the time, who later became my boss at Cosmo during my first tour of duty. And I also interned at Sassy under Jane Pratt.
We were just talking about Sassy right before you came in here because the younger generation doesn't know about Sassy.
It was really cool.
I mean, I was talking about how they used to have articles and they would be written by just one name. It would be like written by Donna. Remember how you guys used to do that? You wouldn't even have like last names sometimes on the articles.
It was
so ahead of its time.
Well, because the editors really wanted to feel like friends and
right.
There was like that familiarity with the audience. But it was incredible. I mean, there were incredible editors there like Kim France, who went on to, you know, start Lucky, and Christina Kelly and Mary Clark and others.
Atusa
Rubenstein was a beauty intern, and she became the original editor of Cosmo Girl. And people like Spike Jones, who's a big, you know, director, producer, movie maker, would do our guy issue called Dirt. And we were on the same floor in that building. We were on the same floor with Ms. Magazine. So it was cool.
That was very cool.
And Jane actually had Dually, which is kind of weird. She had a talk show on Fox, of all places. And I interned at both. So I was interning at Sassy, and then I interned for her at Fox. And I actually ended up going on the show. because she needed, you know, she needed a guest. And it was about, I think it was about good guys finish first, meaning like you should date a good guy, not a bad guy. And I happened to be dating a really nice guy. So she got us to go on. And I'm like, that's when interns would do anything you ask them to do.
Years later, like, Jane would interview me as a kind of guy expert. She had a radio show or something.
Yeah, she had a show on Sirius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me what you learned in that time. Like, that was a real crash course for you. I mean, are there certain things that even during that time you still take today?
I mean, what I learned is you do anything when you're an intern, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to be really hungry and eager and show up and sort of do what's necessary. And some of that is amazing creative work and some of it isn't. I mean, you know, you can probably say you don't want to be on a talk show if you want, but barring that, you sort of do what you're asked. But also the importance of relationships, because I was an editor at Sassy that ended up telling me about the YM job, the editorial assistant job at YM, which became my first job. And in publishing, I mean, sure, you know, there are job listings, but so often it's word of mouth and, you know, somebody putting you up for something and cultivating that reputation. So I learned that early on because I got my first job through an editor, you yeah. know, that I worked with on the internship.
And do you still think it's that way today? Is the system, the sort of mentoring system, still kind of in place like that?
Yeah, and it's not even so much mentorship. I mean, there was mentoring that was going on, but it was more that, you know, I had done a good job. They hear from their friends, hey, I'm looking for an editorial assistant. Do you know anybody? And then you come to mind, you're front of mind. So it's about the relationships and the reputation.
So your first big job was at YM.
Right, under Bonnie Fuller.
Under Bonnie Fuller.
Yes.
I think Bonnie Fuller has come up in about 70% of my interviews.
Yes.
Because she's crossed everybody's world. And I worked for Bonnie at Glamour.
Yeah, so she had just, she hadn't been in the States that long. She's, you know, came from Canada. She brought Donald Robertson with her. So he was the creative director.
He was at Glamour, yep.
So she hired me and it was a very low paying job. I can tell you that because I had to wait tables at the same time that I had that editorial assistant job.
That is amazing. I've never heard of an editor.
So you go into it for the love of it and not necessarily because it's lucrative, and it can be lucrative later, but in the beginning.
What'd you love about it?
Well, I got to interview a lot of really cute boys because it was YM.
And of
it
course.
It's sort of like the teen version of Cosmo in a way, if you think about it. This was before Cosmo Girl existed. It was super creative. Yeah. And because it was for a young audience, they really relied on the youngest staffers to contribute and to really say, like, this is what's apropos in my life. This is what's going
on. So it was really relevant to you.
Yeah. And again, you know, great editors, like, just amazing people.
Yeah. I mean, for all Bonnie's intensity and flaws, she's an amazing editor, had great instincts, right?
Amazing instincts.
Yeah. The golden gut, as they used to say. So after YM, what happened?
For just a few months, less than a year, I went to this, it's a newspaper really supplement called React, which was like the parade for teens.
I remember it.
And there were great people working there as well. And so I was there for about 10 months. And then some of the editors at YM went to start Teen People at Time Inc. And they pulled me from React to be one of the founding editors of Teen People.
So you were at Teen People when I was at Twist.
Yes.
Yes.
Remember that.
It was a little bit hard to compete. I actually just interviewed Lisa Lombardi, who was the editor-in-chief of Twist at that time.
I know
you know
Lisa.
Yeah, from YM and stuff. Yeah, it was always like you were this behemoth because you worked with, you know, you were in the AOL world and AOL was just coming. So when you were doing Teen People, what was sort of the mandate there?
Yeah, so it was obviously modeled after People in the sense that there was real, quote unquote, real people coverage, because celebrities aren't real people.
Yeah.
Celeb coverage and real teen coverage and that sort of, you know, mixture of those two things. And it was very innovative at the time. And it did super well. It was also one of the first magazines to launch dually with a website. Which I know sounds crazy now, but
I know they were ahead of that for sure.
Yeah.
Now it's like kind of retroactively happening.
Yeah. And it was very well received. It obviously, it's funny. We had toyed around with so many different names that didn't have People. You know, we wanted some cool name that was just ours. And, you know, this is when you would go out in the market and test things. And of course, the brand recognition of People is so powerful.
Too powerful.
So we ended up with Teen People.
And Teen People was a great name. Yeah, it's impossible. Like, had you been like Sugar or something like that, it might have been easier to compete. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a great experience. Again, it was, you know, tons of amazing editors.
So you're still kind of in the teen market at that point. When do you graduate to the next level?
Right after Teen People.
Okay.
So Elliot Kaplan, who until like just the other day was the editorial talent director of Hearst.
Yes.
Called me for Cosmo.
Okay.
And originally he called me, I think, for a news job. And I don't even think I threw my hat in the ring, but right after that, he called me for a deputy editor job. And I decided to go for that. And it was, you know, in hindsight, I wasn't quite done with Teen People mm-hmm. in my heart, but I decided I needed to go for this next bigger job. And I was with all my friends at Teen People. We had a bunch of us had come from YM. You know, we were doing great things, getting accolades. The magazine was doing well. But I just saw this opportunity to come to Hearst and to work for Cosmo, which is so iconic. So I went for it. I got the job. And then I came over to Hearst.
So we're going to see that there's an interesting circular
yes.
part of your career that you became deputy editor at Cosmo, and then you're going to leave Cosmo, and then you're going to come back in a much
right.
bigger role. But
yeah.
well, that's just a spoiler, you know, it's coming. So you go to Cosmo, and who was the editor? Kate White at that time?
Kate White was the editor.
And I don't know if you recall, but there was a guy, I think his name was Jonathan Small, who was writing the Guy Guru column. I don't think you were my editor. I had many editors.
No,
I think you
wasn't
were way
your
too
editor.
High up. You were too high up. But what does a deputy editor do?
So a deputy editor
like a sheriff. He comes to town. I'm the deputy editor.
Yeah, does a lot of didn't have to wear a hat or a star
right,
or anything. But you do a lot of top editing. So other editors work funnels up through you before it goes to the executive editor and editor in chief. So you know, by the time it gets to those levels, it should be in great shape. So it's a great job because you get to actually get in there, and you also get to manage younger staff and generate ideas, which is critically important at any stage, right?
And were you assigning stories at that job?
Or
yeah, mainly
I was doing that too.
Doing that too. And were you ever writing during this time?
Yeah, I would. I did a lot of cover profiles or, again, like, you know, dibs on guy interviews, like Josh Duhamel and McConaughey and Ed Burns, who I love. Ryan Phillippe. Actually, Ryan Phillippe, when I interviewed him, he was married to Reese at the time. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends was like, he had a huge crush on him. And I just mentioned it in the interview. I was like, one of my friends is your biggest fan. And maybe you could say hi to her on my like recorder. He's like, let's call her. We called her. And I could hear her hyperventilating, like, on the other end of the phone.
That is
and
so awesome.
And I earned, like, major friend points. And it was just, he was very sweet and really made her day. But, and then all of her roommates for the rest of that summer would write, like, they had this board where they'd, like, write, you know, if somebody called. Or, like, this, like, message pad or something. And it would be like, oh, you know, Michelle called, like, you know, John called, Ryan Phillippe called. Like, they just, like hazed. But, I mean, they just were, like, hazing her for the rest of the summer
that
because he had called.
That is the
greatest
thing.
I was just so happy she was home.
Yeah.
You know, or available to pick up the phone.
Oh, man, to have a recording of that would have been awesome.
Yeah, it would have been. I mean, I could hear her, like gasping for breath.
Now, was it an easy transition from writing for teenagers and kind of you have that voice and it's a very specific voice
yeah.
and it changes from magazine to magazine, but it is often very conversational and kind of like you have to use words like guys and
well, like
boys
the
sometimes.
Like the colloquialisms of the time
yeah.
and yeah. And I mean, to graduate to Cosmo,
yeah.
I mean, Cosmo's still a young audience.
It's still young, but it's like
not teen.
Yeah.
And also when you're writing for teens or for any audience, you know, you want to use their vernacular, but you don't want to force it either. So I think you have to kind of weigh on the side of caution when you're doing that.
I remember it was so hard to come up with different words for hair.
Yes.
Like tresses. Yeah, the strands.
And strands. And
there's like how
dude,
many times you say
like,
hair.
Oh.
And then, yeah, there were some
yeah,
other
you're
ones.
You're so right. That's funny.
Hair was a tough
that.
One.
Hair was a tough one.
Hair was a tough one. So you're at Cosmo, and you were at Cosmo for a while.
Yeah. So I ended up within a year being promoted to executive editor, which
right.
is the number two spot right under the editor-in-chief. And it was premature. Like, I definitely wasn't experienced enough or, you know, I guess, quote unquote, old enough at the time to have really been considered for that job. But that's what was great about Kate. She saw the work. She thought that was up to par and, you know, gave me that job, which she has since said, you're the only person I've ever given a job who didn't ask for it. Because one of her rules is You have to ask for it. You have to throw your hat in the ring. You have to want it and be hungry and be eager. And I wanted it, but yeah. I probably then didn't think I had earned it yet. But she saw something in me I guess I didn't see in myself. And so she gave me that job.
So we're talking about Kate White here, who went on to become a novelist. And
yep, she still is.
She still is. And was always very supportive of me and my career. So love you, yeah. Kate White.
Love you, Kate White.
What did you learn from Kate White? I mean, was definitely a mentor type figure.
That could be like a, 20-hour podcast. I mean, so many things.
Yeah, well, what are some of the things? I'm sure sometimes you channel your Kate White, even in this job that you're in now, right?
God, so many things. I mean, the importance of, making time to think about the big picture while you're in the minutia of the day-to-day. And I think that's an important lesson in life, like planning where you want to be or live or, what your relationships are going to look like. Same with work. You can be bogged down in all the emails or the Slacks, now Slacks, then emails, the day-to-day copy, all of the things that we're dealing with in a deadline-driven business, but you have to build in time to think about where's the magazine going? Like, where do we want to be? What are the big picture things? And so she was big on that, and it served her very well. So I've tried to think about that too.
Yeah.
She was just, she is so much fun, especially at a brand like Cosmo, making sure you're infusing it.
Yeah, with energy and fun.
With energy and fun. And
yeah, I can't come into Cosmo and be like the Debbie Downer.
No. I mean, we cover serious topics, obviously, but there's, a lot of levity in the magazine and humor. I think, what she did with me, giving me a chance and just letting the work speak for itself and not really thinking about age appropriateness. I mean, she's just, no matter what, you feel like an underachiever next to her because she was editing huge magazine.
I never understood how, and I have to interview her because I've never understood how you can edit a huge magazine and then also write like mystery novels.
Right.
And raise children.
And travel all over the world and have a couple of homes and I could go on and on and on.
She was also a model, like in her very early career, she was a model. I remember she was on the cover of 17 magazine. Mm-mm. Oh, it was in 17.
The cover of Glamour.
No, Glamour, that was it. And we would have, I remember there was a poster of it up in her.
You should definitely interview her. Yeah. I mean, she's got a bunch of books out and one of them is a career book that's sort of a updated version of her best-selling Gutsy Girl book from years ago. So
I'd ask her for career advice.
Yeah, you should. I think you're doing it.
I think, okay.
But I learned a ton from her. And one of the things I did learn from her was about sort of, seizing your personal life too. I mean, she had a full life in every respect. She was a huge traveler, which I am and probably became under her.
Okay, so you're at Cosmo years of your life.
I'm at Cosmo as a deputy, get promoted to executive editor within a year, and then stay for like another 7 years, which is a long time.
In magazine years, that's like many years.
It's a long time. And it's because, I was growing into that job, first of all, and there was so much responsibility in it. Managing staff, helping Kate with the lineups, working on every single cover. So if you think about it from, 2001 to 2008 or whatever it was, I worked on every single cover of Cosmo. And I look back at those covers now and I remember, crafting some of those lines with Kate. And she had a rule that we weren't done until we were howling with laughter.
Oh,
like,
really?
That was the bar. If we didn't clear that bar, we weren't done with the cover and we had to keep working.
So the cover lines had to be funny.
Really funny.
That's so interesting. I never would think of it that way.
Really funny. I mean, sexy, yes.
Yeah. Like eye-catching, yeah.
Yeah, sexy for sure. It had to have that combination, but definitely outrageous, provocative. And some,
do you still think of that? I was going to ask you.
I do. I think that, the tone has changed a bit in the world, and it was, well, actually, it's changed a lot.
In the world.
In the world. And we were able to be much more liberated about, what some people would call man pandering now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like, it was a magazine that in part was about pleasing your partner. And it sold like gangbusters. So, not an issue, but just a tone that I don't think would be as embraced by young women of today.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to get into that
because
the fact that you've worked in different eras of the magazine is really interesting.
And some things have stayed the same. The core tenets of the magazine have stayed the same, but some of the tone and definitely the cover tone has changed a bit. But so I did that for a long time and we started the Sirius satellite radio station. The website was just ramping up. So all the digital innovation was happening. So there was a lot going on
in that transition. I mean, in occupied during that period. And that was, magazines were hot. There still are, but you know,
John?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, it wasn't just about print. It was starting to not be just about print magazines.
Yeah, there were lots of brand extensions happening, and of course digital. So it was a very vibrant period and a great, and we had events and fun fearless males and all
fun,
that.
Fun fearless males. I'm sensing a theme here.
You can't be the editor of Cosmo and not, you know, be, yeah, a little,
not be
boy,
a little
crazy.
Boy crazy. That is true. And it was always good to explain boys to women. That was always my job. And I understood.
Male mind reading. That was one of the things that Cosmo was really good at, was sort of what we called male mind reading stuff, which is really just getting inside guys' heads through talking to, you know,
inside
people.
The male brain. Yeah. Because
the way you tick is so different.
It is
the way
different. It's interesting. I could understand how men tick, although I'm not really the typical man, but I could always sort of get inside the brain of the guy that I think that most...
Right, or you can reference your sort of friend group and
exactly.
guys you've encountered, and then obviously, you know, talking to experts.
I was pretty good at giving advice, but taking my own advice, just the worst.
Well, we're all bad at that.
We're all bad at that. So after Cosmo... What happens?
After Cosmo, I become the editor-in-chief of Women's Health magazine. And at the time, Women's Health was, you know, obviously modeled after Men's Health. But it was a much more vertical, what we would call a vertical title. It was black and white covers, fitness models, very much kind of hardcore health and fitness and nutrition. And the company wanted to transition it into more of a lifestyle magazine. And sort of the same trajectory that Men's Health had gone through. And so they hired me to be the EIC to kind of take it through that transition. So when I got there, we started booking celebrities. And
did you have to move to Pennsylvania?
No.
I would never
have taken the job because I'm a passionate New York lover.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
And now I'm a passionate LA lover too, but at the time, exclusively a passionate New Yorker. So no. So Dave Zinczenko was the editor-in-chief of Men's Health and at the time the editorial director of Women's Health. And so he hired me, will forever be grateful for that. He's a good friend of mine still.
He's a good guy.
He hired me to be the editor-in-chief of Women's Health, and that was a big leap. But I felt really well prepared for it, having been the number two at Cosmo.
Mm-hmm.
I always say
How
that
so?
Being, because I say that being the executive editor of Cosmo is like editor-in-chief boot camp. You know, it is such a big brand, as we just said. So much going on and, you know, big and successful and, you know, there was a lot of responsibility in that number two spot. So, and I was in it for a long time.
Yeah.
So I felt like I was ready to make that leap. I mean, of course, you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, it's different.
You must have been itching because I was number two for a long time in my career.
Yeah.
And you are, even though you love Kate, and I don't know, was Kate the only editor that you worked under there?
At Cosmo, yes.
At Cosmo, yeah. So you love her and you're not wanting to like unseat her. But at the same time, you're kind of like, oh, it'd be kind of interesting to know what would be in charge.
She didn't go anywhere for a few years after that. And also I had been working on Cosmo at that point for 8 years. And I was itching, but other editor-in-chief jobs had come up that I didn't throw my hat in the ring for. And it was because I felt strongly about going for something that was a good fit for me. Like, we both know people who just single-mindedly wanted to be an editor-in-chief. And they didn't care if it was, like, you know, Road and Track or, you know, Cat Fancy or Cosmo or whatever.
Yeah, they wanted to
and
be the boss.
That wasn't me. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was ambitious and I wanted to advance, but I wasn't – I didn't have that editor-in-chief tunnel
vision.
Right,
and you also – at this point, you're still working for magazines. I'm assuming Women's Health is going to be the same way, that are in your interest set. Like you're not – again, you're not working – you might be a cat person. I don't know, but you didn't go to Cat
I'm
Fancy.
Not actually.
Okay. Like I would be thrilled to be a cat.
For the record.
Yeah, for the record, if Cat Fancy is looking for an editor-in-chief, I'd actually like that job. Yeah. But so you always kind of stuck with magazines that were in your interest set. I mean, I think.
And that definitely was. And so I felt like that was a great fit for me. And also, it was going to be a lifestyle magazine. So it had the core of the health, fitness, nutrition, which I loved and was passionate about. But then it was also going to have fashion and beauty and some sex content and other things. And so it was sort of the.
Was there a big culture shift for you?
Perfect amalgam. Yeah. So I left the Hearst Tower, went to the Rodeo.
We're in the Hearst Tower right now.
We're in the Hearst Tower.
That's so
the
cool.
beautiful Hearst Tower.
It is amazing.
Looking at Central Park.
Yes.
And yeah, it was. But one of the cool things about the Rodale culture is that it is almost exclusively health and wellness driven brands and enthusiast brands like bicycling and Runner's World. And so the community of editors really lives that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Not to say, you know, we don't go out for drinks after work and have fun and, you know, indulge, but there is, you know, a lot of passion for the content there.
And I worked at fitness, so I have some understanding of that. It's nice
to... Yeah, we've had sort of, we've lived parallel lives in some ways.
Yes, you're a
Cosmo
female me.
Cosmo and Glamour.
Right. Okay, so Women's Health, how long were you there?
So I was there for just about 6 years.
Okay. And you also wrote books, or was that after or during?
I did write one book when I was at Women's Health called Look Better Naked.
Yes, great name. Did you come up with that name?
I did. And then it became like one of the cover lines that we used.
Yeah, I was saying it's such a cover line too.
Yeah. So that was fun. And then I actually, towards the end of my Women's Health time, I was about to do another book. And then I went to my next job, which we can get to in a minute. And Rodale kept me on as the author, even though it wasn't going to be a Women's Health branded book anymore because I wasn't at Women's Health. So then that was called 20 Pounds Younger. So I left Women's Health and Rodale. And again, there's a theme here, which is like leaving before you're ready kind of thing. I was ready probably to leave Cosmo, to be honest. But Teen People, I sort of left prematurely. And
jumping into the unknown, right? Like you
jumping into the unknown, but really seizing the opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we can get very comfortable with like our colleagues who we love and become family to us and the content that we're working on and just, you know, all of the things that go with staying in a job for years on end. But it's important to sort of, if you spend enough time, you don't want to be a job hopper.
Right.
But if you've spent enough time to actually say, like, this is an opportunity that might not come around again, and so I need to seize it. So Yahoo was going through one of its many, many, many iterations and starting what they called, I mean, their digital company, were a digital company. They don't exist anymore. Like a magazine, you know, division. Mm-hmm. They were starting these digital sites that they were calling digital magazines. And I was like, why do you want to co-opt the magazine name? Like, you know, it's like everybody's trying to be like the opposite of what they are. And they were making some really interesting hires. They had hired Katie Couric. They hired Joe Z, who had been the creative director of Elle, to lead their fashion, quote unquote, magazine or style magazine. They hired Bobby Brown, beauty guru, to do their beauty stuff. And then they came after me for health. And at first I was like, I don't, you know, I'm not really ready to leave Women's Health. But as I started to hear more about it and to see the talent they were acquiring and to think about the fact that it was going to be a really deep digital education, and womenshealthmag.com reported to me. And so I had some of that, but I wasn't responsible for the day-to-day operations.
And you saw the writing on the wall, like, you know, the print business was changing.
The print business was changing. Yeah. I, you know, saw my own media consumption habits changing and just felt like, hey, this is an opportunity. They want to hire an editor-in-chief without a ton of digital experience. They were, you know, willing to pay a salary that was commensurate with being editor-in-chief, which is not the case in all digital properties.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And so I knew I'd get to spend some time in Silicon Valley, which was, you know, interesting to me.
Yeah.
And so I made that leap.
And what did your magazine friends say? They think you were crazy. You were pretty early to that.
I don't think they thought I was crazy. I think they were surprised that I left Women's Health. You know, we had gotten a lot of accolades. We won some big awards and were nominated for big awards. And we were sort of bucking the decline that a lot of magazines were experiencing at the time. And I think they thought, wow, really? Like, you're going to, like, this is a good deal. You're going to, you know, leave this. But I think there was a bit of envy too, because everybody was sort of trying to figure out, like, how do I make that pivot into digital, or how do I at least get a taste of it?
They're still trying to figure that out.
And I think some people are backtracking from it too, saying like, okay, I tried that and it's not as much fun as I thought it was going to be.
Being in the digital thing.
Well, because it's, you know, it's a grind to produce so much content on a daily basis.
I was going
to
ask you, what was the big difference? Was it one that you were creating so much content?
There were a lot of differences.
Yeah.
One, Yahoo is an enormous company and Rodale, a smaller company. Yahoo was very matrixed. It was, you know, based in Silicon Valley.
You were in New York, though.
I was in New York again. But the differences were vast. And not only the company and how giant and matrixed and just the way it operated was crazy because we had quarterly performance reviews. There were so many checks and balances, and in some ways, tons of autonomy because it was such a big company and it was a new thing and we knew what we were doing versus the people who hired us, you know, didn't really know how to produce a quote unquote magazine. But then no autonomy in that you had to do these like quarterly performance reviews and like
right.
you'd have to have five people give feedback on every employee. And that was just so much paperwork and bureaucracy and things they don't tell you when you're interviewing for the job.
Right. It's really the Silicon Valley meets the, you know, traditional publishing meets digital.
Just,
and yeah, you're in a different culture suddenly.
Yeah, a different culture. And then going to Silicon Valley for quarterly meetings and, you know, probably more frequently than quarterly, which was a very different scene than, you know,
like
New York.
So. With like not, you know, not like, as much black.
Like
and...
if you watch the show Silicon Valley,
yeah,
you know,
it's pretty accurate.
It's kind of accurate.
Right,
yeah,
I
like
know.
Male-driven hoodies. You know, if you showed up super dressed up as you might coming from New York, they'd look at you like you had six heads. Like, why would you wear that? Like,
right. So editorially, how was it different?
But it was different in that way because one, the, you know, production of content was so much more, the volume was
just
so much greater.
Out. Yeah.
And I had like four or five people reporting to me versus 50.
Mm-hmm. It's like lean and mean.
I had no walls. I had no office. So I went from the corner office into the open floor plan that is digital. And I've never gotten sick so many times in a year.
Oh, that's funny.
But I actually grew to, and I knew that was going to be the case. You know, that's how digital works. And I was fine with it because the office is not the important thing at all. So I knew that. And I grew to like it, actually. I grew to like the interaction with the team and felt, even as the editor-in-chief and the boss, so much more connected to everything that was happening. Of course, you're always connected, but in the hearing every sort of conversation that was happening about every post, you're more so, you know, intimate with what's going
were
on.
Were you, the way they package stories was different, is different online, and it keeps changing because it depends what platform you're on. So right now we're talking about a website, right?
Yes,
which is different than a social media
very
post.
You know, the Yahoo audience is very news driven. So
okay.
even though it was health content and there were some evergreen aspects to it, it was mostly news driven. So
was
what
all was women's health or was it health for both
nope, for
genders?
Both. Yeah,
so now
which that was new.
That was new for you.
Yeah.
So it was a more of a news focus, more of like
very
really being on science.
More of a news focus. Obviously what's going on, you know, in that day. And also one thing that we learned was how to take something that on the face of it doesn't seem like it would be a health story and kind of find the broad ranging, you know, health, because it could be mental health, it could be emotional
right.
health, it could be, you know, sexual health, and find the way into a story that was getting a lot of traction.
Is the next step Cosmo? It's like with bated breath, I'm waiting for Cosmo.
Okay, so the next step was actually the most daunting, which was that Yahoo decided not to continue on with this, you know, magazine division that they had started. And it was for, you know, the macro reasons. They were positioning the company to sell it, dumping properties, you know, slashing the workforce, closing international offices, and, you know, positioning themselves to sell because Yahoo Health actually was performing really, really well. Health content in general, you know, does well and did well for Yahoo historically. So it didn't make sense that Yahoo Health would be one of the things that they would decide to shutter, but they did. And so I found myself without a job for the first time in 23 years. And that
it's scary.
Gratefully, I had a contract.
Yes.
So I still had a paycheck.
Yeah. Let me tell you, I've had fun without a job without a contract.
Yeah,
and that
exactly.
is a terrifying
so,
feeling.
So, you know, listen, it was kind of scary because I had never not had a place to go to in the morning. I was a worker. So I was used to doing that. And that was the cadence of my life. And so suddenly I was like, whoa. I'd never worked for a magazine that folded and I'd never gotten fired. So I knew that it was a very unique opportunity to be paid, have time off, think about next steps, and take a longer vacation than a week.
So you weren't unemployed too long or un-
I mean, it ended up being 6 months in total, which happened to be what my was the runway that was left on my contract.
Yeah.
If you tried to plan this, you could never do it.
Yeah.
So don't do this at home. Don't try this at home.
Right.
It ended up being just this glorious experience of taking time off, traveling, which I love to do, having space and time to think about what I wanted to do next, having a lot of interesting conversations without the responsibility. You can go on a vacation when you have a job, but you always have the responsibility of that job in the back of your head. Going on vacation when you actually don't have any work waiting for you is a completely liberating experience.
Yeah.
So that was great. And yeah, just talking to people in different industries and thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I actually wasn't really looking to leave the wellness space because it meant so much to me personally and professionally, and also is such a burgeoning field. You know,
it's even become wellness instead of health. They used to call it health. Now they call it wellness.
Yeah, wellness is more encompassing,
yeah,
and it feels less clinical and medical. And
now it'll be women's wellness.
Is just more 360 in that way. So I wasn't looking to leave health and wellness, whatever you want to call it,
right?
Because I knew it was, you know, it's a, I don't know, $3 trillion, you know, business with all like products and media,
yeah,
and things. So I had a lot of interesting conversations. I actually thought about moving to LA.
Oh, you almost made that jump.
I recommend it highly. But then Hearst came calling with Cosmo.
So how did that happen? Did you just all of a sudden one day get a call and be like, hey?
David Carey and I had stayed in touch. David Carey is the president of Hearst Magazine.
Okay, just so everybody knows.
Sorry. I thought it was he was a household name. And we kept in touch over the years. And, you know, David is amazing at many, many things, but he's very attentive to talent and keeps an eye on it and you know, sort of keeps tabs on where you're going. And he's just, he always says he's an Olympian when it comes to email. He's like a great emailer. He's really responsive. And I don't want him to get barraged or anything.
Right.
With emails,
I was just sending him one now.
He's very responsive.
That's very nice because
super nice.
So many people don't get back to you on email, especially the younger generations.
It's true. And he's great at that given how busy he is. It's kind of mind blowing. So he reached out to me, you know, just to say, hey, sorry about Yahoo, but you know, tough times for a lot of organizations and, you know, let's get together and, you know, talk. So I'm like, great, after my long vacation. So I went to Asia. I, you know, was in LA and then I eventually, you know, made my way back to New York and we got together and just started talking about whether there might be an opportunity for me at Hearst again. And I would have, you know, at that time I knew I would be thrilled to come back to Hearst. It's a great company. And so those conversations progressed over a bunch of months while I was having conversations with other people too.
Right. Which always helps to have leverage.
Yeah. A little bit of leverage never hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And obviously it's, you know, it's all out now that they were thinking of elevating Joanna Coles to chief content officer.
So Joanna Coles was the editor in chief of Cosmo.
Right. So in between Kate and me, Joanna was the editor for 4 years, I believe. And so they were wanting to elevate her to this executive role of chief content officer, the first time the company had ever had one, and were looking for who would be quietly, very quietly, it wasn't out in the open, looking for her successor. And I, you know, had the kind of resume credentials to potentially be that person.
You were actually 8 years at that particular magazine, and you didn't just come in as Cosmo's editor-in-chief, or was that your first job? Because I heard that you recently got a promotion.
Right. So, again, another sort of boomerang.
Did you have to do sort of a little bit of a test? Like, did you have to put together a test magazine?
Yeah. I mean, we had a lot of conversations, and I had to kind of give him a memo, but it wasn't, you know, what in the industry we consider, you know, tests. Now, you know, at basically every level until you get to editor-in-chief. You have to do an edit test. And it's just a horrifying part of our business.
It's horrible.
But it's necessary.
You need to know.
The work is really important. The ideas, the editing skill, all of those things. And so when I became an editor-in-chief at Women's Health, I think I actually said, does this mean I never have to take an edit test ever again? So I've never had to take a test again.
Just to tell people what is an edit test. So you have to, sometimes you
it can be
anything. Like come up with 10 ideas.
Yeah, it's usually a few headlines. Different things, right? Yeah. Come up with ideas, edit a piece, and you know, either give sort of notes that you would give to the writer saying, here are the revisions I want you to make, or actually you know, redoing it. So usually some form of that, ideas, potentially brand extensions or cover lines or whatever you'd be working on. Yeah, so I had to do, you know, a memo of sorts, but he knew I understood Cosmo from my time here. And also, you know, women's health has a little bit of shared DNA in that same way. It's a similar demographic. So yeah, so then I was offered the Cosmo job, which
you were pretty psyched.
Still pinching myself, to be
pretty
honest.
Pretty awesome. So Cosmo, is Cosmo the biggest women's magazine in the world?
It absolutely is. It's the biggest young women's magazine brand in the world. And, you know, only four other people had been editor-in-chief of Cosmo at that point. So it had been Helen Gurley Brown, obviously, for 30 years.
The legend.
Who's the legend. Yeah. And I had a chance to meet, because when I was at the company the first time, she was still working in the international division. I have a couple of typed letters from her, typed on a typewriter.
Oh, that's so cool.
And one of them's framed in my office. I'll show it to you. And then Bonnie for a year, and then Kate, and then Joanna, and now me.
Pretty big shoes to fill, for
giant
sure.
Shoes.
Giant shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all like, and then the interesting thing is,
and I revere all of them.
Yes.
So definitely daunting.
So when you came in, it was nice, I guess, to have Joanna, because she had been at the helm.
Yeah.
And nice, it also intimidated me, because now she's going to be your boss and she knows Cosmo better than any magazine probably at Hearst.
Right. Well, she was the editor-in-chief of Marie Claire, too.
Okay, that's true.
So she had been the editor-in-chief of Marie Claire internally before coming to Cosmo. Yes, but to her credit, she, you know, gave me a lot of space and autonomy, and also So Cosmo was filming. So we were all very busy.
Tell us about Cosmo.
So I walked into a reality show on my first day on the job.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that just is a sign of the times, right? So not only are you taking over, you know, like the biggest job of your life and, you know, all the daunting people who came before after being on a long vacation, which is a whole other ricochet.
Right. There's a camera in your face.
But there's a camera in your face. So, yeah, so Joanna was the central character. I don't know if that's the right word, that, but
yeah,
you know,
in reality,
the central
she's
person
the protagonist
in So Cosmo, along with a bunch of fashion and beauty editors. But obviously it was the perfect opportunity for a little drama to show the transition. So my first day was the show's first day filming, and they showed the actual announcement to the staff that Joanna was leaving, and then a couple of hours went by, and then they announced I was coming. And then I show up a couple of hours later. So it was really what would have been probably compressed in, you know, real world into one announcement was spaced out because they wanted to capture like some of the reaction. And
they need drama, and there might not even be a natural.
I mean, you can't build – that was an authentic, you know, experience that dramatic transition was happening. And they were able to capture it. So
was it pretty accurate, you think?
Yeah, that part was, just because it was, you know, what was actually happening.
Yeah.
She announced she was leaving, you know, announced I was coming, and then I walk in the door.
So now your title is what?
So now my title, and I walked in as editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan and editorial director of 17. And that was Joanna's title as well. So I assumed the same position that she had.
But now you've taken a few more things under
your
belt.
So now Hearst has acquired Rodale, my former company.
Amazing. So now you've come back.
And see, it all comes around.
Just when I try to get away, they pull me back
in. right. I'm happy about it. Hearst has created a new group called the Young Women's Group that I am now editorial director of. So that includes Cosmo, Women's Health, and 17. But I remain the editor-in-chief of Cosmo.
Got it. Okay. That's a lot of responsibility and seems like a lot of work.
It is. We hired an editor-in-chief for Women's Health, Liz Glasser, who's great. So she'll be, you know, heavily involved in the day-to-day operations. But obviously, I edited that magazine for 6 years. Sure. It's part of the Young Women's Group. So from a demographic perspective, it makes sense for us to all kind of be aligned. And Liz is a first-time editor-in-chief. So it's always nice. You know, I had Dave Zinczenko. She has me. It's nice to have, you know, sort of a guardian.
Somebody who's
when
been
you're
there.
Going through that process. Yeah.
Tell me how Cosmo, from the time that you were here the first time around, is changed now that you're here the second time around in a much bigger role.
Yeah.
And first, let's talk about just where Cosmo was in the ecosystem of publishing at that time and where it is now, but also just like how people have changed, how the environment has changed, the culture has changed.
Yeah.
Like, so I know it's a big question.
It is a big question. So just to sort of back up to some of the things that we were talking about earlier, I mean, Cosmo remains, again, it was the biggest young women's global brand
right.
then. It is now magazine brand. But the tone was different in that we spoke to straight women for the most part and a certain percentage of guys who have always read Cosmo. We were unapologetic back then about the sort of, you know, hey, you want to please your partner stuff. Now the tone is different in that, you know, sexual fluidity is a more embraced lifestyle. So we delve into that.
We mean sexual fluidity.
Meaning that we don't just exclusively speak to straight women who are dating men. We have a very different tone on the cover. It's not that we never say guy or never say man or never talk about doing something to please your partner, but it's, I think, less the focal point than it used to be. And it's mm-hmm. more about the equity of pleasure.
It's interesting that you say equity because I noticed how to give and get, how to get and give supreme pleasure. Was a headline. I thought about that. I was like, I don't know if that headline would have been in 2002.
It probably wouldn't have.
No.
But it's only right, John.
It's only right. It's only fair.
It's only fair. And it's not that back then we didn't address, you know, women's needs.
Right.
We absolutely did. But the sales tool or mechanism on the cover was more about how you're going to be a great partner. In that realm, there were other cover lines at the time that were about career, fitness and health or whatever, personal safety that were just directed at the female audience.
But no, ew, I've got a gross disease. Do you remember that headline?
I remember, I assume we can talk about all those cover lines.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The ones that you, like just recently, Kate and I were talking about one that just made us crack up, which was what to do with an iffy stiffy. And I'm like, I cannot believe we put that on the cover, but we so did.
That would never go on a cover now.
Probably not.
Although that's funny. It's not
super funny, but I think that the humor was actually even different. Like, I think humor is a little more nuanced and sophisticated. And back then it was a little, I don't know, more juvenile maybe, and like cheekier in that way.
It's good to see that we've evolved as
a
species.
We've evolved a little. I don't know. I don't know if I have personally, but yeah, there were some really funny cover lines. Like I remember we did a roundup of stories about accidental orgasms. So it would be like, I was running around the track and boom. I'm like, really? That happened?
The accident.
So it was this roundup of accidental orgasms. And I remember.
I hate those. They're so awkward. Yeah.
And I remember the cover line was something like, it was in quotes, like a first person quote, my car turned me on. Or something like that. I don't know.
That is the best.
There were so many good ones. You know, we should be doing a reading right now.
I would.
Cover lines.
It's true. That's a whole other podcast. We just read the
cover. What his butt shape says about him. We could basically take anything and be what it says about him. Oh, it's very telling.
It is very telling.
Really,
I remember it was
really
what his salad bar choices. We got a little bit crazy.
Found an expert
that found out if
expert.
He likes lima beans, it's he's definitely not into committed relationships.
But see how much fun that was? We're laughing.
Yeah, it is fun. And how do you do your cover line meetings? Take us behind the scenes of how a cover line meeting works.
Yeah, so I choose the stories that are in that issue that I think are cover lineable. Ask the editors to submit cover lines for them. They send them in a big group. I sift through them with, you know, one of my top editors, like my executive editor. And then after that point, I generally work with the creative director to compose the cover.
Are cover lines still very important?
They are still important. I mean, it's still, you know, we're still on the newsstand. We still sell a good number of copies on the newsstand. And so it's a combination of the person and the cover lines. And, you know, it's difficult to say which is more important, but I would almost say the cover lines are more important because There's obviously a lot of variety there. You can maybe connect with the person on the cover and be like, hey, I'm a huge fan. I'm going to buy the magazine because of them. Or I like the way they look, or I'm interested in hearing what they have to say and I want to get to know them better. But there's, you know, a whole bunch of lines about a, you know, diverse array of topics that you could say, oh, there's like five things that are making me want to buy it now.
So when you came into Cosmo, what were some of the things that you wanted to update or change?
Well, I do, you know, we've been talking a lot about the humor and the levity. And I do think that, you know, Joanna's she's a fun person to be around, but she gravitates towards a more serious.
She's a news background. Yeah,
she has a news background. She gravitates to a more serious subject matter and had done a lot of important coverage in Cosmo that we continue to do. But I think in doing that, maybe some of the humor, you know, just took a back seat. And so I wanted to bring that back. And also because we had entered such a serious time in the world. Mm. You know, think about what the last year has been like. Yeah. And so I really felt like, although Cosmo covers political issues, things that, you know, matter to young women, that have to do with our rights and empowerment and all of those things, I also felt like we still owed it to the reader to, you know, kind of be a moment of rest.
Like
and
like a escape a little bit, mm-hmm. from the reality.
Yeah.
Do you have like lots of focus groups? How did you kind of...
Oh, focus groups.
Yeah, those are always fun. I remember sitting through those and just wanted to kill myself.
It's like we don't do them anymore and people have always questioned their validity to begin with. It's such a, you know, small group of people that are usually somewhere in the tri-state area. It's not necessarily representative. And also a lot of, you know, the digital users are not the same as the print buyers. And so even the things that do, you could say, of course, there's probably a relationship in the content that does well because Cosmo as a whole shares a sensibility across its different incarnations and platforms. But, you know, it's really a function of gut, talking to young women, how well the magazine sells, and just sort of what's happening in the world and wanting to be relevant.
What are the articles that do the best in Cosmo? Has that changed at all?
No. Because at our core, we're, quote unquote, a relationship Bible. So people come to Cosmo first and foremost for that sort of advice, right? And it really is advice. It's a service-driven magazine. It's like navigating relationships is one of the most challenging things that we all face. And it's even more challenging now than it ever has been because of, you know, app dating culture, and we're more connected and more isolated at the same time.
Yeah.
And also gender roles changing and the divisiveness that we're experiencing at this moment in time between men and women. So I think that Cosmo's core mission in that sense is to help people navigate that very important part of their life. And so we're more necessary now than ever, as well as, you know, empowering women, obviously, to live the lives they want to live, to have the careers they want to live, to have the relationships they want to have. So, yeah. So I think at its foundation, its mission hasn't changed.
Has it been hard with the whole Me Too movement and what's going on in the... And again, I know you're trying to put more humor in the magazine, and I think that's a welcome...
Yep.
But has that been hard to balance? Like, you don't want to make light of that, but at the same time, it's like...
We absolutely have covered
it.
Right,
and you do. Like
so not... I don't think it's been hard to balance because Cosmo's always been sort of that mixture of like the lighter-hearted pieces and the more serious ones. I mean, Cosmo, you know, people might not recognize this, but we have always talked about reproductive health, freedom, rights. We've always talked about personal safety, all of those things. But it's just that everybody else is talking about them now, too. So we have all the fun things, and then we've covered the, you know, the whole sexual harassment and assault phenomena that's happening right now in the Me Too movement in a variety of ways. So in the current issue, we have a piece about how to talk to your mate about your Me Too moment, because one of the things that we realized as all of our Facebook feeds were filling up with these stories from friends and acquaintances and people that we knew is the scale of the problem. And how many women had experienced these things in varying degrees. And then we started hearing that when they would talk about it with the, you know, with their mates, that they would get a variety of reactions. You know,
right.
Some guys feel really protective, and there's the two different reactions. One being like, I didn't protect her. Now I feel really bad about that. And it's, you know, making me feel shitty. And then there's the, you're making too big a deal out of like something some guy said to you at the, you know, at the office. And that dismissiveness is very damaging.
Yeah.
So we, you know, did this piece that I think is unique to Cosmo about how to have that conversation.
It reminds me of like what you said about when you were at Yahoo Women's Health. It's finding the angle that Cosmo is going to take, right?
Always critical. And I think that's probably one of my most important jobs, right? Is when editors funnel ideas through me to constantly make sure that they understand we should be seeing it through a very specific lens that's not, you know, the same lens that everyone else is seeing it through. So that's an example of, you know, kind of covering that subject material. I also write in my editor's letter the month before about how Cosmo's mission, first and foremost, is to empower women and to give them the tools to live the life that they want to live the fun, fearless life that we always talk about in Cosmo. At the same time, we have a long history of celebrating men, which we've touched on in this conversation, and it feels really difficult to do that right now. To laud men is unpopular right now. And my perspective as the editor of Cosmo and personally is that we can't treat men like a monolith, like they're all one thing and malign them all. I mean, that would just be ridiculous. The same way, you know, we're not, all women are not the same. We're not one-dimensional people either. And so I brought that conversation up and, you know, we had a piece in the magazine that was aimed at guys. And now this conversation is happening more and more, where people are starting to react to some of the false equivalencies of like just ensnaring all guys
in
something that maybe they shouldn't be caught up in. So we at least need to be having that conversation.
And it's good that you're having a conversation because guys are very confused right now.
Well, that's my point, right? So guys are confused because of the awareness that we're all experiencing, which is a great thing. We're all, right, you know, hearing about these stories now and women are feeling, you know, more comfortable being transparent about them, that we all, it also causes confusion because guys are like, I'm not sure what's okay. Of course, there's the egregious behavior they should be clear on, but then there's like the, is that a compliment or an insult? Is that appropriate or not appropriate? And like what context? So I've been talking a lot here with editors about helping guys navigate that. And what's really interesting is, here, there's not a lot of empathy for guys. And even among, you know, young women who work here, they think, what do we need to tell them how to behave? What, like, they should know that on their own or be able to figure it out. And I'm like, guys, like, being this divisive is not going to be helpful for any of us down the road. Like, we've got to find a way to reunite.
It's like men and women are like the Democrat and Republican Party. We're like, you know, it's so it's polarizing.
Very polarizing. And so we are beginning to have those conversations and talk about what Cosmo's role is in kind of bridging the divide again.
How is Gen Z different than Gen X? Like, are you seeing...
Oh, my God. That's such a big question.
I know. What are some of the fundamental...
I mean, there's probably, you know, better people to ask than me who study that all day, every day. And I think one of the problems with kind of categorizing millennials and, you know, whoever, whatever generation, disease wise, is that you are forced to treat an entire generation like a monolith, right? Mm-hmm. So inherently, you're going to mischaracterize people. So it's hard to do that. But what I would say is that the millennial women that I talk to are extremely confident and extremely self-assured about kind of what they want out of life and feel like they can carve out their own roadmap. You know, they're not, I don't think they feel as beholden to all of the same blueprints that, you know, maybe we followed.
Yeah. I was thinking because I remember in the beginning of this conversation, you talked about how you were so grateful to have an internship and to work with all these amazing women. And I wonder if it feels like the same with your interns now, like when they come here, are they so grateful? Like, to...
I mean, listen, we try to hire the best of the best.
Of course.
So I think that they are, but I definitely sense differences, you know, even and beyond the intern level, I sense differences in, you know, our youngest staffers here who have a casualness and a sort of we actually did a story about it, like I forget what we called it exactly, but it was about kind of being too familiar. It's like we live in such a casual, I think social drives this a lot, you know, and all of the acronyms that we all use and texting world, like you don't even like have to form real sentences and, you know, use punctuation. And so that bleeds into interactions too. I mean, listen, I pride myself on being super accessible and I'm always out chatting with like all the editors and, you know, hearing their stories and stuff. And I have an open door all the time, almost all the time. So I get why there's that comfort level, and I don't ever want them to see me as like in some ivory tower. I don't want that. At the same time, it kind of shocks me when I ask, say, my assistant, like, can you have, you know, Jane Doe pop into my office? I want to ask them a question. Jane Doe has no idea what I want to ask. She just knows that she's been asked to come to the editor-in-chief's office. And then Jane Doe will walk in and say, what's up? Like, and I'll be like, really?
Yeah, you're like, oh, really? Like, where's like, a little bit of decorum?
Like,
yeah.
I don't ever want to be scary. Yeah. I don't, you know, I want them to feel comfortable. Yeah. But I think back to when I was, you know, their
like,
age.
Terrified.
And if I would have been called into the editor-in-chief's office, even if I knew I hadn't done anything wrong or I wasn't in trouble, your spine straightens a little bit.
Yeah,
it wasn't, even if I was close to that person and super congenial and friendly with them, I still would have been like, whatever it is they need me to do, like,
I don't know where that comes from. I guess it's parenting.
I don't know.
I mean, I guess it's the way we are, people are raised.
It's just the tone of the world. It's just a lot more casual.
And does that seep into the magazine's pages editorially?
Oh, totally. I mean, it's funny because, you know, we've talked about colloquialisms and vernacular, and now it's really just, you know, a bunch of letters like strung together, you know, like it's texting language that makes it into the magazine. And I have allowed it to be there, but I also rein it in a lot because the young writers and editors on staff will just like litter the entire magazine with, you know, with letters that half of our audience might not know, you know.
Letters it's mean like acronyms.
Oh,
and
acronyms
like-
and, you know, yeah, just all the texting like beyond the WTFs, you know what I mean? Like there's, I mean, define the relationship. There's don't give a fuck. There's,
and by the way,
I
that mean, can also seem forced if you do too much of that, right?
To my point earlier. Yeah. But it's just, I'm trying to think like for the win, like, you know, all the acronyms, like, and we do, we use them, but it can also be too exclusive too. If it's like, oh, well, if I don't know what that is, maybe this magazine isn't for me. And also, can we just use a word sometimes, guys? So I'm down with it
words
and we
important.
Do it, and I actually, it's so funny because, you know, AF is like AF everything, you know what? Yeah. AF is right.
Wait,
John,
AF oh as god
fuck.
Oh, I don't even
know. Are we allowed to swear
fuck
on this podcast?
Yes, you can.
Typically,
and I didn't even know as fuck. I say sometimes
should've
as fuck, like I'll be
more,
like yesterday I said this banana pie is good as fuck. I don't
right
know. Yeah.
But you don't even have to say as fuck. You just say AF.
Yeah, that's cool.
So even though in the beginning it all just seemed kind of ridiculous, after you are immersed in that culture, you start using it. So
right
now I'm like, I say, you know, AF now. Like that workout was hard AF.
Oh, wow. People. Oh, okay. I have not heard. My son is 12. He's
well,
getting.
Maybe that's just
and
me.
My daughter's 8. Yeah. So they're not quite at that age. The articles you write about sex, I know we talked about, you know, different gender roles now and that kind of thing has come in to play this time around, or in this era. There was a lot of, like, you talk about service. So Cosmo's always known for like writing stories.
He leaves the naughtiest question to last. Isn't that
how
they
do it? That's how you always do it. You always do it. You win their trust.
Yeah, see, I know the tricks.
You know the tricks.
I remember you don't like start out interviewing a celebrity
like
asking them about their relationship.
Yeah.
They shut you right down.
Oh, you're good. It's really hard to interview a pro. They know everything.
But I'm happy to answer it. So
I don't even know what the question is. I mean, no. So the question is, so it was very much about performance, service, you know, how to, you know, it was always about like you had another G-spot you didn't even know about.
Right.
Are we still doing that kind of thing?
Totally. Okay. Yeah, still
because
doing it.
People haven't really, their bodies haven't really changed.
No, but science always, you know, science advances and, you know, techniques and toys and all sorts of things evolve. And Yeah, there's always more to say on that topic. It's an endlessly fascinating topic.
What's the most sort of mind-blowing thing in the last few months that you've discovered that kind of came up in your...
Yeah. Let me think about it. I mean, like, the most fascinating... I don't know. We did a story a few months back about... This was a guy... a guy-driven story about finding his pee spot to give him a peegasm, which is prostate. And there's a very specific way you have to find it. And we told readers, which I was a little like, whoa, this is a little much. But we did in the classiest way possible.
Classiest way possible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's information you need. It's
what I like. I mean, that's, again, trying to bridge the divide. But the stories that I like are the ones that, like, we just recently, I mean, all the months blend together. I think it was last month, February, did a story that was about how to have shower sex that doesn't end in the ER. And I see, to me, that's like
that's the quintessential
Cosmo story,
totally.
Because it's got sex and humor and service all built in. Because when you think about it, shower sex is one of those things that's like made for movies.
Like, seems like a good idea at the time.
Seems like a good idea. But when push comes to shove, you could definitely end up in the ER.
Yeah.
And pushed. So we like actually did that story, which was funny, but also practical.
And was it rooted in some, like, were there some stories from ER nurses? Like, we get so many of these shower sex victims.
We've done those stories in Cosmo before, like sex that ended in the ER. A penis can be broken, just so you know.
I know somebody. I can. Heard.
And it's supposed to be a very,
very
excruciating
painful.
Experience. So we've done those roundups. This was actually more of a service-driven story about, like, positions and, like, and, you know, accessories.
Helpful.
And, like, just things to do to just keep it all safe.
So it must be fun when you're coming in. It's like my last questions, but like when you're coming up with that, those ideas and the idea, is that those guys, do those ideas kind of come out of just sitting around a round table and
Definitely.
Kind of bantering, everybody's talking about, okay.
Yeah. And we have so much fun. I mean, Cosmo is, you know, we cover the important topics, like the ones we were just talking about with Me Too and other issues, and have, you know, we have a column called On My Mind that has amazing contributors. Cecile Richards is contributing. Elizabeth Warren has written for us. Hillary Clinton did the intro to a huge piece we did on how to run for office. We cover all those things. But yes, we have a lot of fun too.
All right. I've had a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks,
John. Thank you so much, Michelle. You've been awesome, and thank you for taking so much time to talk to us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
For listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella, reminding you to do the right thing.
Thanks, Ella.
You're welcome.
Perfect.
Can you listen to it?